Brian Levin, Mineral. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Jim Thurber. I'm the director of the Center for Congressional and Presidential Studies, the School of Public Affairs, American University, and we're proud to co-sponsor a series of events called Ceasefire and Healthcare. These events are intended to bring people with differing views focused on healthcare problems in America, the problem of finance, cost, quality, access, other problems of healthcare. This is the seventh in the series. We're joining John Breaux, Senator John Breaux, to do these forums. He'll explain the background of Ceasefire, but let me tell you that through the forums, and we've had Hillary Clinton and Newt Gingrich and others, we found a lot of common ground. The idea is to find common ground on solutions to healthcare, not just describe the problems. And indeed, we started during 2004, AU did, American University, bringing together the healthcare specialists from the two campaigns, from the Kerry campaign and the Bush campaign. It was remarkable. They agreed on 80% of the solutions to healthcare in America. The idea is to get some momentum behind policies here in Washington to stop the partisan deadlock, permanent campaign over healthcare, the wedge issues on healthcare issues, and try to solve some problems. The perfect person for this is Senator John Breaux, who had 32 years experience on the Hill. He was known as a person in the middle, not far left, not far right, bringing together people, and he certainly had great experience doing that from the Senate Finance Committee and also several commissions since then. I give you John Breaux, who will moderate this discussion between Secretaries Shalala and Secretary Thompson. John Breaux.
Thank you very much, Jim Thurber. Thank you very much, and good morning, and welcome to another edition of our Ceasefire on Health Care in America. I want to thank Jim Thurber on behalf of American University for being one of our sponsors and coordinators for all of the Ceasefire on Health Care events that we've had. I think this is about number seven, I'm not sure, but at least number seven, and we will do additional ones in the future. I just got an invitation from Secretary Shalala to come down to Miami and do one down there, and that sounds like a wonderful opportunity. I also want to thank Pfizer Corporation for the good work that they have done in helping to sponsor the programs and helping to coordinate the ones that we've done, not only in Washington, D.C., but in other parts of the country. And this, indeed, today is a very special one because of the very special guests that we have on the program today. Just a little bit of history about Ceasefire and what we have done in previous events. We've tried to take the concept of Crossfire, which we all remember is a program which encouraged people to come on the program and argue and fight and shout at each other and see how loud they can be. It's interesting to note that program was canceled. I think people got tired of people shouting and hollering at each other. So I came up with the concept of perhaps having a ceasefire program where you could bring people of opposite political persuasions, opposite political parties perhaps, to come and talk about one of the most important domestic issues that we have in this country, and that is health care for American citizens, and to do it in an atmosphere that did not encourage people to argue and shout and fight, but rather to encourage people to see if they could find common ground on this very important issue. And just as a matter of information, we've had Ceasefire on Healthcare programs so far with Senator Bob Menendez and Congressman Joe Schwartz, Democrat and a Republican. They joined us and talked about the Patient Navigator bill that they worked on together in the House of Representatives. We followed that up with a program at the National Press Club between Senator Hillary Clinton and former Speaker Newt Gingrich. Obviously opposite parties and opposite political perspectives, but finding common ground again on the solutions to some of our health care problems in this country. We had another ceasefire with Senator Johnny Isaacson from Georgia and Congressman David Scott. We did that one down in Atlanta on community health facilities. toured their facilities and found out how they were working together to improve the community hospitals providing health care for indigent Americans. We've also had pollsters, Democratic pollsters, coming in with Republican pollsters to talk about, in a separate poll they did, to find out what was the view of American citizens on this issue. And not surprisingly, they found that they wanted, American people wanted, elected officials to work together and cared less about which party got credit for doing something, but were more concerned about getting them to work together in order to be able to find solutions to these very difficult problems, which are practically insolvable if people don't talk to each other. So this is a continuation of this series. And today we're going to talk about a number of issues, and we are so delighted because we have two outstanding panelists. I mean, I could not have asked for a better selection than two former secretaries of Health and Human Services. First, now from the University of Miami, where she serves as president, formerly president of the University of Wisconsin, before that, and served with great distinction, and of course the Clinton administration as secretary of HHS. I think LSU played Miami last year, but maybe not. We won't talk about that. But please join me in welcoming Secretary President Donna Shalala. Thank you, Donna. And of course, succeeding Secretary of HHS was a person I also worked with, as I did with Donna very closely, on the Medicare program and a number of other medical issues when he was Secretary of HHS. In the Bush administration, served there with great distinction, and served as governor of his state of Wisconsin previously, in a previous life, and I understand he has some important decisions to make on, at least he's indicated that maybe making some of these on May the 15th, which incidentally is the day when all the Medicare recipients have to decide whether they're signing up. I don't know if there's a connection with the choice of that date, but he's currently with Aiken Gump Law Firm here in Washington, D.C. I'm with Patton Boggs Law Firm in Washington, D.C., so we get our two commercials in, but we're delighted. Please join me in welcoming.
You got yours in. I haven't got mine in yet.
You got yours in. Aiken Gump. Please join me in welcoming former Secretary of HHS, Tommy Thompson. Tommy? Let me start, and they can use this opening time maybe if any general comments, but I think the question we'd like to start with is that we still have millions and millions of Americans who do not have health insurance during any one portion period during a year's period of time. And arguably, we are the strongest nation in the world and maybe the strongest nation in the history of the world, and yet we have as many as 40 million Americans who do not have access to health insurance. Seems like we give you health insurance according to which box we put you in. If you're old, we put you in the Medicare box. If you're poor, we put you in the Medicaid box or the CHIP box. If you're working for someone who provides health insurance, you're in the employer-sponsored box. If you were a veteran, you're in the VA-sponsored box. And I've always felt that you really ought to get health insurance because you're an American, not because we put you in a box somewhere. And I'd like to ask, maybe starting with Secretary Shalala, why is it that here we are in the year 2005, and we've been talking about these issues for so long, Madam Secretary, why is it that we haven't been able to figure out something yet that resolves this problem of the millions of uninsured?
Well, I'd like to say campaign finance reform, that there are a lot of interests that play themselves out here, and we've been able to put the politics together only to add boxes. That 40 million plus, it's probably 44 now, would be much larger if we had not built bipartisan support to pass the Children's Health Insurance Program. Because there was a constituency, a political constituency, to get health care for the children of working families. So we've been able to add pieces. We have not been able, and certainly the Clinton administration tried, to add all the pieces. And there are a number of reasons, but if you look back to Social Security and Medicare, during those times there was consensus about the problem, and that is that we had a big problem of the elderly not having health insurance and the disabled, but more importantly, that there was consensus about the solution. There wasn't a private market solution. We weren't debating with the private sector. Everybody finally came together and said, this is one that the government has to do. The others have not been that clear.
Tell me what you think. Why haven't we been able to bring both sides together to address this issue, or have we? I mean, we still have the large number that are uninsured, but still a lot of them have insurance. What's the problem?
The problem, John, is that Congress really doesn't act, as you know, unless there's a real emergency. That's number one. And it's getting to that point where it's a real emergency. 40, you said 40, Donna says 44. I think the latest figure is 45. And that is going to go to 54 million in the next 5 or 6 years. And the truth of the matter is that when Congress passed the Medicare Part D, it was the type of thing that had happened right before the presidential elections. And of course it got demagogued, as you know, and got criticized severely. And the worst thing that a congressman wants to ever happen is to vote for a complex bill and then get criticized for it. And as you know, the president and Congress got criticized for voting for Medicare Part D. And as a result of that, after the election, there was really no real desire. I know I asked the president after the election if he would take on health care as the number one issue. And I was told by the palace guard that it was not health care, it was Social Security, because they tried Medicare and got criticized. And I think there was a mistake, and I think it really was. When you look at it, you look at the uninsured, and you realize that the most difficult situation is that the uninsured need coverage. And where does the uninsured go for their coverage? They go to the emergency ward. What's the most expensive health care in the world? It's emergency care. And the truth of the matter is, you can actually change, and I hope we get into this, you can actually change the uninsured and make it a stimulant to the economy rather than a detraction to the economy. And you can do that by requiring states to, as Massachusetts has just indicated and has agreed to, put the uninsured into an insurable pool and allow the state governor to put it out for bids. And evidenced by Medicare and Part D, we had a tremendous amount of interest in bids. We thought that if we could get three bids, national bids for Medicare Part D, we were going to be very good. And if we got five, we were going to really think we had a huge success. We got 10. Instead of 10 to 15 regions, we got 50. And so the private sector really wants to bid on this. If you put every uninsured into an insurable pool and put it out for bids, you're going to have very low bids, and you're going to be able to provide for insurance coverage. But you got to put a stopgap loss on it. And that is something that we need to do and we need to discuss. But I really think it's doable. And I think if you cover the uninsured, you're going to be able to turn a distraction from the economy to a stimulant. And you're also going to encourage companies to come back into the insurance market, which is something they're getting out of and something I think is really sad.
Thank you, Tommy. Don, let me ask this question. It seems that there are some Democrats who take the position that in health care that the government has to be the one that does it all. On the other hand, there are some Republicans who would take the position, it seems, that, well, the government shouldn't be involved at all, the private sector should do it all. And it seems like in Part D, Medicare, we were able to combine the best of what government can do with the best of what the private sector can do. Is that a possibility as you look towards the uninsured and maybe try to have a blend between what government does best and with what the private sector does best?
Well, the answer is yes, and there's a long Democratic tradition of doing that. Before Part D, Medicare is in fact managed. Those are private insurance companies. After after Social Security, the debate was never, is the government going to do everything? The government was certainly going to pick up the bill, but it was going to use the private sector for the management and for the delivery system. So there is a tradition, and there is, I think, very much a possibility of blending the two.
This is a health care conference. We'll talk about health care. If y'all want to talk about health care, that's fine, but if y'all would like to talk about something else, we'd ask you to please leave the room. This is a health care debate, and it's not a debate about anything
shame
else.
On you.
So if y'all would be polite and please
shame
exit.
If y'all would be.
I think it's shame on you. If y'all would please exit.
Okay.
If y'all would please exit. Don't even get it. Would y'all please allow us to have a program? We're not interfering with your participation. Would y'all please exit? If y'all want to talk later, that's fine. Not ruin a health care debate. Would y'all please exit and give us a chance to have a health care debate? That's pretty important. And stop interrupting. We don't interrupt your meetings. We would like you all to please exit and let us have a health debate, and you can talk about other things later. I'm sure you're concerned about health care, too. And please, we'd like you to please leave, and please allow us to have a meeting. Thank you very much. Thank you. We've heard you. You made your point. Thank you very much. You made your point. Thank you very much.
Workers go on strike.
Hey, take the lead and follow
four
your buddy out.
Have gone to the hospital
hey, look, the door is right on your right, and your other friend has already left. Thank you all. Very good.
So.
Now we're going to go ahead and have our
why
discussion. Thank
so
you. Say bye bye. There's a door.
Because they want a union. Why?
Say
better wages, and they need health care.
And they don't need you shouting in the room. That's not the time to do it. Good night. Goodbye. So long. Thank you all. Thank you. Thank you. We're talking about that. If you let us have our meeting, we'd like you to. There's the door. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Enjoyed having you all here, but there's the door. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Can someone help escort this gentleman and lady out as well? Thank you very much. We appreciate your comments, but this is not the forum. If you want to have a forum, go to the location where they're having a forum on that subject. This is not it. Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate it. Very good. Love the pictures. Thank you. Bye. Thank you. Okay, we can get back to the subject matter at hand. The question, I guess, Tommy, was I'd ask Secretary Shalala about the combination of government and private sector working together on this. Can you give us your thoughts as a former secretary in a Republican administration about can the private sector and the federal government work together? What's the answer?
The answer is yes. The answer is it needs to. And just like on Part D, we found that it was extremely successful by putting it out for bids. The same thing can happen with the uninsured. You're going to have to really allow for the private sector to develop the insurance policies that are very, very centrally attuned to what the group needs to be covered. You cannot allow for the legislature of the Congress to add a lot of mandates on it. It's got to be one that is really necessary. You also got to consider strongly, and I happen to support that, what Massachusetts did, and that is requiring health insurance, the coverage of health insurance. This is a little bit opposed to what Republicans really think or propose, but the truth of the matter is just like automobile insurance, you've got to have coverage. And if you're going to be able to cover the uninsured, you're going to have some degree of a mandate to cover the uninsured. Go beyond that, that's the government portion, and then allow the private sector to come in with proposals that are going to be able to be conducive to the uninsured, you're going to be able to cover them. You're going to also then need the government to come in with a tax credit in order to subsidize
some financial assistance.
Some financial, and then on top of that, you're going to have a cap. The reason the cap is because we're seeing a tremendous decline of employer-covered insurance in this country. We've gone from about 75, we'll probably go below 60%. And especially those companies with 25 or fewer employees are getting out of the market. And in order to get them back in, you've got to be able to allow for some degree of insurability, some degree of certainty.
Now, we tried in the early days of the Clinton administration, remember the controversy surrounding the employer mandate,
right.
Particularly some of the small businesses in the country really went almost berserk on and their opposition to the employer mandate. What are your thoughts, if you would share them with us, with regard to the concept of what Massachusetts is working on with an individual mandate?
Yeah. Well, the employer mandate is certainly controversial when you have a small business because you have no connector, no pool to buy into. So, I mean, you just, if you've got five employees, there's no way you can buy in. The demonstrators were just demonstrating, but they forgot that the University of Miami has an employer mandate for our contract employers. And in fact, the person whose picture they were showing gets health insurance, a comprehensive health insurance plan, for $3 a week. So it's a heavily subsidized employer mandate for health insurance. The debate's over card check versus election, not over substance. But individual mandates is where Massachusetts went, and that's because it's a state that has only 10% uninsured. Almost all those people are working. So they went to an individual, but it works only if you have a pool in which they can get their health insurance from, because they certainly can't go into the market and buy it as an individual. And it's the old bro plan, or the new bro plan, which is the individual mandate combined with the pool, combined with subsidies. And then the debate's over, where'd you get these subsidies from?
You know, it's really interesting. It seems like, and anybody can comment on this, is that, you know, it almost would be better to have this individual mandate, number one, because a large majority of the people who are uninsured are really between the ages of 18 and 35 and very healthy. And they also, many of them, half of them, work for companies that offer health insurance. They just choose not to partake, to take it up.
But more employers would do the mandate, I think, or at least participate, if they had an affordable plan, which, you know, universities struggle with this too. We want our contractors to have health insurance, but they struggle to find an affordable plan for their workers. So if there was an affordable plan, you might be able to have a combination of an individual mandate, plus those employers that really wanted to do it could go into a pool and get an affordable plan, because many employers want it as a competitive edge, but they need to be able to get into a market and get a reasonable priced plan.
Wouldn't it be better then if you have, say, an individual mandate, wouldn't it be better to have it, on a nationwide basis so that you could form the pools of various states coming together than each state doing it separately by themselves?
Well, I think that would be better, but the truth of the matter is I don't think that's going to happen, John. And the practicality of politics in Washington right now is that nothing like that is going to pass. That's why the state of Massachusetts, and I'm very happy when Donna gave me the waiver to try something in SCHIP, I gave him whatever he asked for.
Those badgers stick together.
I was able to give Governor Romney the waiver this year to allow for the plan that's in Massachusetts. But I think Massachusetts is sort of the tipping point. I think other states are going to follow through. But I think unless the federal government is going to be able to come together, which I don't think they are, states are going to do this.
That's an interesting point. Is it impossible for the federal government? Can we only do baby steps? I mean, broad-based health reform by the federal government, can that not happen?
No, I don't believe it. If you look at the history of welfare reform, and in fact the history of Social Security and of Medicare and of Medicaid, there were a lot of state experiments going on. The use of waivers by the federal government where you don't need to go get a vote in Congress to do it. And so if you have enough experiments going on around the country, you fill in the gaps with perhaps some kind of a national outline, but you build up a consensus around the country by the states trying things out the way Massachusetts is taking the lead now, and the way Tommy Thompson did in welfare reform. So I would see the role of the federal government to encourage state experimentation to get coverage. Now, sometimes you get underfunding, the way you do in Tennessee. We gave Oregon a kind of waiver to try to get more coverage, but again, it became a financial problem for them. But the way to build up support for national coverage is to encourage state experimentation. We've seen it before. It's the way our national politics works, and I think there's a real opportunity there. But the federal government is going to have to be flexible as well as thoughtful about how it allows states to reorganize the funds that they have.
I see Governor John Engler out there nodding about the state experimentation there.
I was thinking of the 10-year anniversary welfare report. Wishing that Secretary Shalala had a chance to recommend President Clinton sign the Black Grant on Medicaid 10 years ago.
where we'd be at experimentation today.
Well, we'd be where we are with this children's health insurance program, where I would argue that if you don't have some kind of a guarantee that the money is going to go up, you run out of money at some point, and you start capping, you know, what states that want to spend the money, like Michigan, want to do, while other states have enough resources to deal with it. But I just, Governor Engler is another example of a governor that experimented and did some very good things. And I think that encouraging that for a period of time will get us much further towards some kind of national coverage.
I think this is important, that we have an agreement between a Republican secretary and a Democratic former secretary about the individual mandate concept, that it's appropriate and proper for the states to try these things out, these broad-based reforms, that it's not likely, in your opinions, that the federal government would be able to reach a consensus on any kind of a broad-based type of health reform.
But 60% to 70% of the Massachusetts funding is going to come from the federal government. So the federal government has to play a role here. That is, they have to be willing to give up, in the case of Massachusetts, some of the disproportionate share money. I don't know what the hospitals that have been getting it are going to do for resources. That raises a whole set of other issues. But the feds are, as they have been in some Medicaid waivers, are going to have to work with the states to help them put these pieces together. But the experimentation is worthwhile, and the goals are certainly worthwhile.
Let's turn our attention, if we could, thank you, Donna, to the SCHIP program. Obviously, the program designed to help ensure the children, the most vulnerable among us, and obviously if you get them on a preventative health care program or taking care of them, they'll become a lot less expensive to treat from a financial standpoint later on in life. It seems that two problems, as I've looked at it, number one, not enough are enrolled. Mm-hmm. How do we get more enrolled? And number two, I guess, which is always a problem, not having adequate funding to pay for the doctors to treat under the program. Any thoughts about the SCHIP program, Tony?
Oh, absolutely. I got all kinds of thoughts about it. But first, I'd just like to respond on a couple points before I get to the SCHIP. Number one, I don't think the federal government is going to be able to come together in regards to coming up with national policy in regards to health care. But I do believe that there is a proposal dealing with tax credits that could be used by the states to subsidize a statewide insurance pool in each state across America. The Bush administration has asked to put $8 billion towards that over 10 years. That's a nice start to subsidize it. The second thing is, Don has indicated, the states need the help from the federal government in order to fund it, but I really believe we need to expand the number of waivers to allow states to have the capacity to innovate. I don't think that the states have been as eager to innovate as they were when John Engler and Arne Carlson and Terry Branstad and Mike Leavitt and Tom Ridge and a few of us were involved at the cutting edge on welfare. And I think states, maybe led by Mitt Romney and Jeb Bush now, will do that. In regards to
a Democrat in there we can throw in?
Yeah, I think Tom Vilsack from Iowa is one that's on that would be willing to try something. I think that would be good, and I think we should be able to accomplish some progress in that regard. In regard to SCHIP, I think the SCHIP was a very good program, but the problem that we saw in Wisconsin with SCHIP, and I asked Secretary Shalala to give me a waiver, and she did, and that was to expand it to parents. And we found that in the state of Wisconsin, that when we allowed parents to come in and sign up for SCHIP the same way as their children, they were much more eager to do so. And Wisconsin had, at that time when I was governor, had the highest percentage of children signed up for SCHIP, and that was because parents also were able to do it. And when you reauthorize SCHIP, I hope you allow the parents also to be signed up, because if mother or father or both are able to get health insurance under SCHIP, then they're much more willing and able and excited about bringing their children in. And just having the children sign up, there's not really the incentive for the parents to do that. And that's why we tried it in Wisconsin, and it has been and continues to be extremely successful. And I think five other states now have followed through. So I think that is the best way to get more children enrolled is by getting the parents.
Yeah, and I think that there would have been a chance, had the resources been there when Tommy took office, to expand SCHIP to parents, because that certainly was something he cared about. But if you look at the individual mandate, and if you look at who it's going to cover, a lot of them are SCHIP parents. I mean, one way of looking at the individual mandate is that you're, in fact, using the individual mandate to cover the parents of SCHIP kids. I see two problems with SCHIP. One is a good thing, and that is it has a much higher match. It became very popular with the states because it has a 70%, minimum of 70% match. So it's more popular than the expansion of Medicaid. So anything you can do to expand SCHIP, the states would like, because it gives them some more resources. The other thing is it really does have limits on it. And when you run out of money, you run out of money. We do not want a program that covers working class kids that runs out of money. So we've got to figure out a way to do that. And some states that hit the maximum were the states that were trying to expand, and other states hadn't hit the maximum, and their money was reallocated. So I would work on those two things. But again, we're talking about working class parents, low-income workers, whether you're talking about individual mandates or you're talking about SCHIP, and some strategy to cover those parents.
It's interesting that it seems that one of the problems with SCHIP is the fact that a lot of people aren't enrolled that are eligible. Either they don't know about it or haven't been convinced.
Well, it's complicated. They're immigrant families. Their kids may be eligible, but they're worried about their immigrant status, particularly in this day and age. It's hard to get them enrolled. They're worried that we'll ask them for more information. Some of the enrollment papers have been more complicated. You've suggested, and Tommy has suggested, some simplification out here, which is what we need to do. There are probably 50,000 kids left in South Florida that still need to be enrolled. But many of them are kids of parents who have some question about their status, and it's hard to get them sign up for a government
program.
You
would agree with having the parents when they would be eligible?
Absolutely, absolutely. And combining that with an individual mandate, then that combination reduces the numbers. Remember that Massachusetts had only 10% uninsured. The national average has to be 16%. In your state, it's over 20%, I think, in your state, and you couldn't do the Massachusetts program without not rebuilding the charity hospitals, probably. I mean, Louisiana would have to have a different kind of strategy.
It seems like the individual mandate works when you can have a consortium of states doing pooling arrangements in order to buy in several different states.
Right.
Let's talk about some of the things that...
The pooling has got to be done on an individual state basis. I don't think you can bring states together in a...
Because they regulate those health care organizations.
Well, let's talk about that regulation. What are the number of proposals that are pending in the Congress that have gotten some momentum behind them, some to a lesser extent? One is association health plans. Mm-hmm. Another is the health savings accounts. Mm-hmm. Another is the Senator Blanche Lincoln from Arkansas, and some others have a plan that builds on the federal employees' health benefit plan, mm-hmm. making it available to non-federal employees. Can I have your comments on any of those, Donna? Do you have any thoughts about them?
Well, you know, I went into the Clinton administration with the talking points about lots of choice. Yeah. I'm much more interested now in choice that fits with the individual. Going to our state of Wisconsin, the health plans that everybody had to do had to have everything in them. And one of the things that Massachusetts did was do some fine-tuning for a health plan for younger people talking about basic health insurance plans. So if you have a health plan in which everybody's got to have every bit of coverage for everything, whether it fits their current situation, it's going to become very expensive. The federal plans have lots of choices, but none of them are so cheap.
Yeah.
So the point about a pool is to get the cost to something reasonable. So if someone makes 300% of poverty, it's actually affordable. Most of the people in the federal health care plan have relatively high salaries. So it's not the organization, it's whether you can get the pool so that you can get reasonable price plans and that they actually cover what the people in the pool actually need.
Thank you, Don. Tom, you have any comments about some of the things that are pending in the Congress now?
Sure, they're all good, John. They're all good as far as they go. The problem is it's a minimalist position being taken by Congress when you really need a whole out frontal attack on the health care system, a holistic approach. And I agree that every one of those proposals in and of themselves have merit. I doubt very much if any of them are going to pass this year. I wish they would, but I don't see much appetite in Congress to pass any one of the three that you proposed. I think the best chance we got to pass in anything this year in Congress deals with information technology, which is probably the best shot of getting a bipartisan approach through. But I think when you look at it, I think the presidential election of 2008 is going to be the one that's going to evolve around who has the best ideas on a real radical departure, but an innovation as to how we insure the uninsured, how we bring change the medical system from a curative one to one of prevention, how we bring information technology to all hospitals and clinics across America and have interoperability from one clinic to one hospital across America. And I think then you have to find ways on liability insurance and so on. I think that is the kind of approach that we need if we're going to be able to have the healthcare system that's affordable and accessible in America.
One of the big Republican proposals is the health savings accounts.
Right.
The argument is that if you're young, healthy, and wealthy, they're great, but if you're old, poor, and unhealthy, that it really is a terrible thing.
I think that you made those arguments quite
unsuccessfully.
Quite unsuccessfully, but very strenuously in the conference committee, if I remember correctly.
I did. Unsuccessfully too.
But I think health savings accounts, in and of themselves, is just part of the puzzle. I think it's they're good as far as they go. And you've pointed out some weaknesses of health savings account. But each one of the approaches that you mentioned, that you talked about, have some kind of weaknesses. They have some strength. I think incrementally, that's all that this Congress is capable of doing right now, and I don't even think they're going to do much of that. I think the overall good of the healthcare system, make it affordable and accessible, you have to really take a look at the total picture and start coming in with a sort of a revolutionary plan to really address all of the issues instead of an incremental.
But you don't think any of that could happen until after the next presidential
election? I don't think so.
Election.
I don't see it.
I don't think presidential elections are fought over health care. I honestly don't. I think people talk about it, and I think it's on the list, but I actually don't think people vote on the health care issues. And we're probably a little further apart than we were 10 years ago on health care, because we're now debating what is health care. Medical savings accounts, mini plans, what should be in the package. We didn't have those debates before, and it means that we don't have agreement about what ought to be covered and how we ought to cover it. So there are some debates going on, but I don't think presidential elections are fought over these issues. I think when most people are asked, they think there's something wrong with the healthcare plan, the healthcare system in the United States, but they think theirs is great. It's kind of like the congressional elections, or theirs is fine. It's not great, but it's fine. So I don't think they vote on health care.
I know this is a ceasefire, and I agree pretty much with what Secretary Shelley is saying, except in this one regard. I've given 100 speeches across America this past year, and I've never seen an issue that is brought to the forefront more strenuously than the health care issue. You only have to look at the automotive industry, General Motors, who is almost on its backside because of health care. You see the declining of small employers, especially those under 25 employees, going down from 75% of those employers 10 years ago covering their employees with health insurance. This year's, for the first time, is going to fall probably below 60%. You see the number of uninsured at 45 million, probably going to go to 53 million. All of these things are coming to the forefront, and I think are going to be the driving force in this presidential election. I granted that it has never been done before, but I think the times are changing. I think also you look out, and you know this, Senator Brough, as well as I do, that 2013 is going to be the tipping point, and that's the year that Medicare starts going broke. And that's the year that Congress is going to have to supplant that money coming into Congress with new dollars, and it's also going to have to write a check for one of those pesky IOUs. And that's going to drive a lot of actions in Congress. And so it's all leading up to 2013, and I think the presidential election...
I don't disagree that there's a problem and people recognize it, and any analyst will tell you it's building up. Where I disagree is where it becomes part of a presidential campaign. Because I would argue for it to be part of a presidential campaign, people have to think in their heads there's something the president can do and that there's a government solution. And I just don't think we're there on a government solution. I absolutely agree that there's a crisis building up, there are elements of a crisis. For that to translate into a presidential campaign, though, is a big leap and a change in people's attitudes about whether they want government to deal with this, at least the federal government to deal with this.
Could it be that with Governor Romney making the proposal in Massachusetts and a potential presidential candidate, we don't know whether he does or not, but if he does, I would presume that would be part of his campaign platform, and maybe that could generate, maybe for the first time, health care as a presidential issue?
Well, like the Wofford effect. Senator Wofford got elected in Pennsylvania,
exactly
that was
right.
Translated in a way in which the candidates thought it was a national issue, and then President Clinton ran from there. Could be, and certainly the Massachusetts plan, I can assure you, will be financed through the presidential campaign. There'll be enough money in that plan. And what happens afterwards, we don't know. But I guess I was burned once, and I learned from that experience that we ought to be careful about taking what is clearly a crisis and translating it into a presidential campaign, and then misreading what the public believes. The public believes there's a crisis, but do they believe that government, the national government, can provide the solution? And I just don't think we're there yet.
People come to government and say, fix the problem, but don't let government having anything to do with it.
Well, it's like those people when we were out in the Clinton health care plan. Don't let government interfere with my Medicare.
Yeah.
And we didn't.
Yeah. Let's talk, if you can, a little bit about the preventative health care.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the statistics are really unbelievable. 90 million Americans today live with chronic diseases. Chronic diseases account for more than 75% of the nation's $1.4 trillion medical health care costs every year, and are clearly the leading causes of death and disability in the United States. We're talking about heart disease, stroke, cancer, diabetes type of illnesses, chronic illnesses. And the question becomes the responsibility of preventative care, taking care of yourself. Good habits, not smoking, and all of these things. And I guess just as a general, is there an agreement about what's the proper role of government in trying to encourage people to do what is needed in order to avoid some of the bad effects of chronic disease?
You said 90 million. CDC latest figures, 125 million Americans have one or more chronic illness in America. And 75% to 80% of that, it's $1.9 trillion this year, 16% of the GDP goes out for health care. And it's going to double from $1.9 to $3.8 trillion by 2013. And unless we do something with the chronic illnesses, we really are not going to get a handle on the costs and expenditures of health care.
How do we do that?
And when you look at it, government's got to play a very strong role. First off, on tobacco, that's still the largest, $155 billion. 442,000 Americans died last year of tobacco-related illnesses. You've got to regulate tobacco as through FDA. There's no reason why you shouldn't.
As a drug.
It's a drug, and there's no reason why you should not do something about allowing employers to do more. I would like to see employers do more in using incentives to get people to stop smoking instead of being punitive. 23 states have introduced legislation this year in order to try and control smoking and giving employers to do it. I think if employers were given the opportunity to get a tax write-off for giving patches and other things and so on and counseling, which would possibly help encourage people to stop smoking. Diabetes, one out of $14 goes for diabetes. Last year was 18 million Americans who were type 2 diabetic. This year it's 20 million, and there are 41 million more Americans that are pre-diabetic. And NIH has done an exhaustive study that says that if you walk 30 minutes a day and lose 5 to 10% of your body weight, you can reduce the incidence of diabetes by 60%. That's huge. That's huge dollars out
so
of it.
So there's a government role in helping to require good habits.
Absolutely. And as Jesse James was asked, why do you rob banks? And he says, that's where the money is.
Is this a Republican concept of encouraging people to have better habits through the government?
I don't care if it's a Republican, Democrat, or Independent, Communist, Presbyterian, or what. But I'm telling you, if you want to control health care dollars, it's got to be in the health care prevention area. And why we wait for people to get sick to spend hundreds of thousands of millions of dollars to get them well and hardly any money for prevention, it makes no sense to me at all.
I absolutely agree with Tommy, but we've got to do it earlier than Medicare, obviously. And we have to sort out what is personal behavior and what is a chronic illness that is caused by other kinds of things. And management of chronic illnesses is where we're going to save money, and we obviously want to do that. We've laughed about the Twinkies tax, taxing unhealthy foods, but at the end of the day, it has to be a combination of all of these things. And making sure that we do all the preventive things, that we teach individual behavior, that we stop cutting out physical education from the schools, and make sure that kids are learning early on about nutrition and exercise and all those kinds of things, are obviously very good investments on the front end. They don't have a big political constituency, but they certainly are good health.
We should even get medical schools to start talking about nutrition.
Right.
I mean, doctors know absolutely hardly anything about nutrition, which is absolutely ridiculous.
Let's talk a little bit about the Medicare prescription drug Part D plan. It seems that what we were trying to do was to take what government can do, which is to help pay for a drug program and help make sure that those who offer it are not trying to scam the system or capable and qualified to offer the plans, and then let the private sector come in and through competition offer the plans that people would have a choice of picking the right plan. I was asked by an editorial board once, could you have made it a lot simpler? And I said, yes, we could have if we just had one plan and no choices and no options, but we did not choose that route. So Tommy, maybe is that type of model where you have government and the private sector, is that something that can be utilized in future efforts?
I really think it can, and I think the tipping point as far as the acceptability of Part D happened, I think, last week. I think the press, the editorial started changing. The Washington Post had a front page story in regards to how many people support the new Part D. I think across America there's a growing awareness. 28 million people now have either been signed up or enrolled. It's going to be 30 million by May 15th, and I think we're going to exceed that. I think that's good. The fact of the matter is, when you and I were talking about it, and you as one of the rump conferees in Bill Thomas's office, those infamous days.
It's easy to be a rump in Bill Thomas.
it was quite an amazing a journey. But we talked about that time. We thought that we might get 3 companies to bid nationally. We got 10. We thought maybe we got 10 to 15 regional. We got 50 to 55 in some areas. And that's a
we
huge.
We also thought the price was going to be about 37.
It's down to 25.
About 25.
25, and the cost of pharmaceuticals have gone down 20% in the last 115 days. So that's positive things, better than what we had anticipated. So I think it's a good model. And I think it's going to be one that can be utilized in the future for revitalizing Medicare when Congress has to start looking at it.
Donna, what about the model concept? Do you think it has
some
merit?
Again, I think this combination of government money and private sector delivery, the private sector costs more to deliver a plan. But that's the model that's politically possible in this country. There's a lot of money in that program, and a lot of money both to be made, but I think companies are very sensitive to the fact that they have to deliver. And the real question is now, is not what the program costs now, but what it's going to cost later, and that's what everybody has been concerned about. It was confusing at the beginning. Most of us spent our Christmas vacations helping relatives get into the program. I must have helped 15 people get into the program, but it is a complex program, and there's nothing easy about Medicare. So some of it was early growing pains. Some of it was designed. As you well know, Medicare has always been designed in a very complex way. But my concern is long-term costs for the program and whether people will start to see certain drugs drop from the program. That'll be up to the companies. The private sector companies, I'm on the board of one of them, have to deliver on this program or people are going to lose their confidence in the model that you're talking about. And for us to expand that model, this is the test for the private sector companies. It's also the test for the pharmaceutical industry, which has been under considerable fire as to what they charge here versus abroad. So it's got to be a partnership between government, the pharmaceutical industry, and the private sector healthcare companies that are delivering. And the test is not today. The test is 2 years from now.
Yeah. Let me ask a final question. I mean, Tommy, let's just put you in a position of being able to get Congress to do whatever you think would be the most important thing they could do in the next Congress with regard to health care. Do you have any thoughts about what that might be in terms of whether it's incremental reform or whether it would be a broad brush type of plan that if you had your druthers and could get whatever you wanted through the Congress, which is not likely, but if you were in that position, what would it be?
My first choice would be to get to an electronic medical record and require e-prescribing. I think that would be the biggest way to transform healthcare in America, and it's something that really we could get bipartisan support for. I think it's very difficult, but I think if you said that in the United States we're going to have an electronic medical record in 2 years, you'd have it. I think the technology is there. You and I are working on a company with e-prescribing right now, and we've got great technology out there. The technology is out there, just whether or not you're going to be able to do it.
Well, that's an incremental reform.
It's an incremental reform, but it actually goes to the basis of a transformation of healthcare, because 98,000 people died last year from mistakes, 50% of them because of the wrong medicine at the wrong time to the wrong person in the wrong amount. And e-prescribing could change that. That is a huge, that is not as incremental as you would like this audience to believe. That is a major thing. And then the second one, of course, is health is going from a curative system to prevention. That's where the money is. And you marry those two and you are well on your ways to transforming healthcare in America, making it more affordable, more accessible, and a hell of a lot better quality.
How about you?
Well, I don't disagree that's what we're probably going to be able to pass, but I would start with the kind of thing that they're doing in Massachusetts that you've been talking about, and that is finding a way to get health insurance to people who get up every day and go to work in this country. Whether it's an individual mandate or an employer mandate or getting pools at the state level, we've got to find a way to get everybody health insurance, but not at the expense of the poorest and most disabled in our society. If you look at the two big steps that have been taken in this country, children's health insurance and Part D, we've just spent a huge amount of money not on the poorest of the poor, not on expanding some programs, whether prevention or otherwise. And my concern about Massachusetts is that their funding mechanism depends on money that's been allocated, the disproportionate share money, that you fought for Louisiana, that had actually been targeted for safety net hospitals, assuming those safety net hospitals deal with just the working poor, and that's not completely true. So the danger here is that we'll have these new initiatives focused on the working on working folks that are relatively low income compared to others, that will, as we have, be shifting resources there, but we'll take those resources from places and institutions that have been taking care of people that aren't covered, that are in fact quite poor.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I mean, I think the ultimate goal, if I could write something, would say that everybody in America should have health insurance, not because you're old, or not because you're poor, or not because you're working, or not because you're a veteran, but because you're in America. Mm-hmm. And then the poor would not be discriminated against because they would have an insurance policy.
Yeah, and it's hard to do. And I know from the university, I mean, those people are arguing over card checks versus union versus elections, but we put in place an employer mandate for our contractors. That was not easy to do. They scrambling to find health insurance. Not only do we pay market wages, but we put in place, but they're scrambling to find an appropriate health insurance plan. What can they find out there? Medical savings accounts, discount cards, some low-income coverage, but you want to be careful about that. I'm nervous about consumer-driven plans because you really have to buy out the front end for prevention. You don't want people to have high deductibles on the front end. So a state pool would make a huge difference that employers that want to do the right thing can buy into to provide health insurance that's affordable for people to get up every day and go to work.
Well, I want to just say how much we appreciate two very distinguished panelists, two former secretaries of Health and Human Services from two different administrations, one a Democrat, of course, and one a Republican, for sharing their thoughts and your ideas and your vision of what we need to do and how we need to get there. I think it's appropriate to thank them very much. Thank you. I also want to say thank you to American University, Jim Thurber, again, for being one of our sponsors for this series of Ceasefire on Healthcare, and also Pfizer Corporation, which is very actively involved in encouraging discussions about what the future is going to be like and what we can do to make our country a healthier and safer place in which to live, and we thank them for their sponsorship as well. So, all of our members of our audience, we appreciate very much your being with us, and we'll be back in touch with a future Ceasefire on Healthcare. Thank you. Thank you.